Okay, here we go. Madeline, welcome. Just in time. So, as I just mentioned before, a few people joined. Really, tomorrow night is Yom HaShoah, but to enable people to attend other programs or programs on Zoom, I had publicized the program of the YU, Tormi Tzion Kollel. Other shuls as well are doing programs, so I urge you to join those programs, to daven, to learn, to think. There's, of course, lots of interesting material and videos online. It's an appropriate time to watch, read stories of people who survived, people who didn't. But tonight, we'll also do a little bit of that, but also in the context of Torah learning, what we've done the past few years. My father suggested it to me a few years ago. My rabbi, Rabbi Adler, growing up in my shul, had done this for many years. And I've heard of numerous other shuls who do something similar or even the same, which is to learn a little bit of Torah from Rav Ephraim Oshri. He was the Rav of the Kovno Ghetto. I'm not going to give a lengthy biography. I think in past years we've discussed it in a little bit more detail. But very briefly, he was born in 1914. And he wrote, you know, of course, so he would, you know, you can do the math. He was a pretty young man at the time of the Holocaust. And he was, you know, obviously considered a brilliant and scholarly rabbi, still young, very young, to be making the kinds of decisions and writing about the types of issues that he was. One of the reasons that he was thrust into that position is because many of the older rabbis were killed. So, you know, b'makom she'einish, in a place where there's nobody else, somebody has to step up. And he, you know, heroically and courageously became the leader of the Kovno Ghetto and wrote five volumes of responsa with the most really heartbreaking, horrifying, tear-jerking questions and answers that you can read, the types of questions that he was giving. Even just earlier today, I was like just perusing the table of contents and just to see the wide array and variety of issues that came up, and some are even almost too terrible to even read. Actually, one of the ones we'll talk about tonight is anyway, you'll see. It's hard to even discuss. But, you know, our learning should be hopefully just a reminder of the types of things that they were suffering through, and also it should be a merit that if we continue to learn his Torah and the Torah that they were dealing with and discussing at the time, it should be a merit for their holy neshamos. Rav Oshri himself, his wife and his children were killed in the Holocaust. He survived. He rebuilt. He married again. He had nine more children. He moved to, I think he lived in Canada. He lived in New York, and he died about 20 years ago. So he was, you know, one of the rare Rabbanim who survived, and his writings survived, and he carried with him and passed on these authentic real life questions and answers that he received. And I want to tonight focus on two of them. One, we will read it inside. It's one of the shorter ones. We'll read most of it and learn it together. The second one is a much longer and complicated tshuva. So I'm really just going to read mostly the question that was asked of him and then sort of skip to the end just to see his final answer. Not really giving its due justice of all of the back and forth and all of the many pages of sources that he quotes in between. But we'll do our best. Hold on, if you can give me 1 second. Sorry about that. Apologize. Okay, let me. I'm going to share my screen with you. Hold on 1 second. I have a lot of windows open, so I can find which one it is. Okay. This is from, I believe, volume one of his five-volume work. The work is called Mima Amakim, From the Depths. These were tshuvos that were written, you know, from the depths of Gehenna, basically. You know, Shir HaMalos Mima Amakim Keresich Hashem. We say, we dive into Hashem, that he should hear us from the depths, when we're from the depths of our heart, but in this case, also from the depths of the pits that they were experiencing, that they were living. So the question that he was asked here is, Bidin chametz she'avar alav ha-pesach besoch ha-ghetto. They had chametz that obviously they weren't able to sell to a non-Jew. The non-Jews, you know, around the Kovno Ghetto weren't so friendly and willing to sit down with them and make a deal to buy their bread and then sell it back potentially after Pesach. In fact, we'll see a little bit more about those details. Obviously, they didn't want to destroy it because they barely had enough food to survive. People were starving to death. So they had bread in their homes over Pesach. They weren't going to eat it on Pesach itself. I guess they had enough other food to survive on whatever they had, vegetables or potatoes, to get through the 8 days of Pesach. But now that Pesach is over, they're starving, they're hungry, and can they eat this bread that's still in their house? Now, obviously, to begin with, we know that pikuach nefesh, saving a life, overrides almost all other mitzvos. So if they were literally starving to death and someone needed some food or nourishment to survive, then of course you eat whatever, you know, God forbid, you eat treif, you eat whatever you have to eat, you eat chametz or Pesach, of course. But here, I guess we're dealing with where they had some other food. They were very, very hungry. They were uncomfortable. They were poor. They were destitute. They needed everything they could get. Could they eat this bread that sat in their homes over Pesach now that Pesach was over? So if you look here, he says, "Vinishalti," and I was asked, "Kedas mala asos b'nidon ha'isur shel chametz avar la Pesach," because not only is there a prohibition to own or to eat Pesach, chametz on Pesach, but Chazal instituted, our sages enacted, that if a Jew owns chametz over Pesach, even once Pesach is over, that chametz has to be destroyed, cannot be eaten, cannot be benefited from it from in any way. That's the din, that's the halacha of chametz over the Pesach. So would that apply in this case? Ki biglasa kanasa nefashos shaisa krucha bedavar, because of the fact that their lives are on the line. There was obviously nobody to tell it to. If they would have gone to the Nazis and asked them if they could buy their chametz, they would have been killed. And not only that, they didn't even want the Germans to know about this little, extra storage of bread that they had, because their food is rationed and they were not given much. And if the Nazis would have found out that they had this extra bread, so that would have been the end of the bread. That would have been the end of the people. So this had to remain a secret. They had to keep their bread in their homes. Could they use it after Pesach? So let's see his answer. Teshuva. B'Shulchan Aruch Orach Chaim Siman Tav Memches. In the Shulchan Aruch, Sif Hei, Pasach, he codifies, he rules. Chametz shenimtza beveis Yisrael achar Pesach. Chametz that is found in the home of a Jew after Pesach. Asur is forbidden. Af al pi shebitel, even though you nullified it. In other words, I'll explain what he says in the rest of the paragraph outside. So there are numerous things that we do before Pesach to prepare our homes for chametz. So hopefully this is fresh in our minds because most of us just did it. We cleaned our homes. We did bedikas chametz to search to make sure there was no chametz left. Some of us, if we had chametz, we put it in a specific place, closed it up, and then sold it to a non-Jew. And then the last thing that we do is bittul chametz. We nullify it. We said it twice, at night after bittul, and in the morning after burning the chametz, we say, kol chamira v'chamia, any bread, any leavened item that I may have missed, that I know about, that I don't know about, that I've seen, that I haven't seen, let it be nullified and hefker, ownerless, like the dust of the earth. So maybe there's a very simple solution here. The Jews who were living in the Kovno ghetto, right before Pesach, could say, listen, we don't want to destroy it because we have no extra food. We obviously don't have a non-Jew nearby that it will be willing to sit down and buy it from us. So let's nullify it. Let's just say, even though it's in our pantry, we're not going to eat it. It's ownerless. If someone comes into our home, in theory, if a non-Jew, a nice non-Jew, would come into our home and say, hey, can I take this bread in your pantry? I would say, sure, it's not mine. I nullified it. I made it ownerless. It happens to be sitting in my house, but it's open for anyone. And then after Pesach, I'll reclaim it. Would that work? Sounds like it could work. The problem is the poskim write, the Shulchan Aruch here writes explicitly that af al pi shebitel, even if you nullified your chametz before Pesach, that is still considered chametz she'avar alav Pesach, and you are not allowed to benefit from it after, for the simple reason that they were concerned that this would lead to what's called harama. Harama means like trickery. What's going to happen is people are going to become very lax about cleaning your house for chametz. Why clean at all? Why search at all? Why even sell my chametz? Here's what I can do before Pesach. I'll just say, hey, any chametz in my house is nullified. It's not mine. If you find chametz, there's crackers, there's pasta, there's cereal. That's not mine. If anyone wants, they can come in and take it. No problem. I really mean it. And then once chametz is over, I'll reclaim it. I'll pick it up and I'll acquire it for myself. It's ownerless anyway, so hey, why can't I just reclaim it? So it would seem like midoraisa, according to the Torah law, that actually would work. Why not? What's the flaw? It's not mine. I made it ownerless before Pesach. I reclaimed it after Pesach. In theory, if someone comes in on Pesach and takes it, I would have to let them, but that's fine. What are the chances anyway? Someone's going to come to my house and take it. So midoraisa, according to Torah law, that works. Chazal said, however, we don't like this idea because what's going to end up happening is people are going to say, my food is all nullified. They're not really going to mean it. How could you mean it if your pantries are full of chametz and there's chametz out on your counters and you just say it's nullified? It's easy to say words, but they're not really going to mean it. Plus, people's homes are going to be full of chametz. So that's a very bad idea. People are going to, without thinking, eat their chametz. It's going to fall into something. We really want people to clean their homes to get rid of it. And if they have some chametz that they can't get rid of, then they have to sell it. They have to really deal with it in a much more serious way than just saying it's nullified. Make them put it away, make them mark it, make them close it up, make them sit down, make them sign a contract in order to make sure that we really take the prohibition of owning and deriving benefit from chametz on Pesach seriously. Nullification alone does not suffice. And therefore, Chazal went so far as to say that that if you nullify chametz before Pesach, but you don't either get rid of it or sell it, even once Pesach is over, that's chametz shaaralo Pesach, and you can't benefit from it. So it sounds like they're in a real bind, these poor Jews in Kovna. Again, they don't want to destroy it. They can't sell it. And nullifying doesn't really work if it's sitting in your house. The nullification, we use it. Chazal tells us we can use that as sort of a backup, a last resort, a fail safe, that if I missed something and I don't know about it, let it be nullified. But you can't nullify your pantry full of bread. I'm sure they didn't have pantries full of bread, but you know, the little shelf of extra old bread that they had, you can't nullify it if it's in your pantry. What can they do? So Rav Ashri says, and you can see in Rav Ashri's Truvos, of course, he's a, you know, huge Talmid Chacham who knows all the Sfarim and quotes from Sfarim that I've never even heard of. And I'm sure obviously he was honest to the halacha, of course. But you can see in many of his Truvos also trying so hard to, if there's ever a time to find a leniency, then it was these Shilohs that were being asked because the poor suffering Jews in the Kovno ghetto. So you can see in many of his Truvos, not all of them, sometimes the answer is the answer and it's not what you want. But very often you can see him trying to find a way to make it just a tiny bit easier. Like these poor Jews, are we really going to make them throw away the little bread they have when they're starving? So he says in the second paragraph, "V'hinei b'sefer Toras Hashlamim." Again, I'm not even sure who authored that, but in a sefer that he quotes from Siman Vav Kasav, "B'nidon echad shehaya b'tfisa be'era Pesach." He writes about a very similar case. He found almost a precedent. There's no precedent for the Holocaust. There's no precedent for the Kovno Ghetto. But he found a halachic case that can almost serve as a precedent for this, of a man who was in jail. It was Erev Pesach. He was in jail. V'haya lo beveso, yayin saraf shel chametz. And he had in his house some liquor. Ima yayin saraf mutter la'achar Pesach. Is he allowed to drink that liquor after Pesach? Because once again, he has no way, he doesn't want to destroy it. Maybe he can't even destroy it. He's in jail. This is in his house. He has no way of selling it. It wouldn't work so well to, you know, go to the jail guard and try to get him to sign the contract to purchase your chametz. So there's really nothing you can do with it. So when he gets out of jail and goes home, does he have to throw away all the chametz that's sat in his house? Or can he nullify it from jail and then reclaim it when he gets home? So the Torah Shlamim writes, Ayin Sham Shamasik, his conclusion there is the imbizmano bitel as a chametz. If he did nullify the chametz in time, then mutar hayayin saraf achar pesach al kol panim ba'ana, then the liquor is permissible after Pesach, at least to gain benefit from. It seems like he's not sure if he would actually allow him to drink it, or maybe just to at least sell it for a profit and then buy new. Sharei b'nidon ze lo shayach arama, b'kivan shayach chavush b'beis ha'asurim. Because the whole reason that Chazal instituted this idea of chametz shavar alav Pesach, the prohibition of enjoying chametz after Pesach, is again, as we said before, because we're concerned of the whole thing kind of just becoming like a trick or a ruse. Like, oh, all my chametz is nullified, but without really meaning it, because do you really mean all my chametz is nullified if it's still sitting in my house? But that doesn't apply to this poor guy. This poor guy would have gotten rid of it. He was doing everything he can. He's not trying to get away with a loophole or a trickery. He's in jail and he has no access to his liquor. So the Torah Shlomim was willing to say, since the idea of chametz shavur lamid pesach is derabbanan, it's rabbinic in nature, and the purpose of the rabbinic enactment was to prevent somebody from, sort of, from doing this trickery that's going to lead to all kinds of violations of chametz on Pesach. But since he's not in that situation, since he's in a unique situation where this is the best he can do, then we'll be lenient and allow him to derive benefit from his chametz after Pesach. And he quotes other poskim who agree with this. Chein hidas of the Rekanti, Haknesa Sagadola, Olas Shabbos, Chein Pasuk B'Shas Shabbos Kivas Penchas. Look at these farmi quotes. But then he quotes the note of Yehuda, who's a pretty significant halachic authority, Yecheskel Landau, Kasav Shafilu Be'ones, Gamor Nami Aser. He's more stringent. And he says this was also agreed upon by Rabbi Akiva Eger, the Chasam Sofer. So there are sort of heavyweights on both sides. In this case, where you have no access, you're doing the best you can. The only thing you can do is nullify your chametz from afar, because there's just no way you can finish it in time before Pesach. There's no way that you can sell it to a non-Jew. Are you allowed to benefit from it after Pesach? So on one hand, again, we have the Torah Shlomim, the Knesset of Bill, Ol Shabbos. On the other hand, we have the Chasam Sofer, Bikiva Eger, the Noni Yehuda. A big machlokas between some of the later poskim. So how do we decide who's right or who we follow? So the Rav Ashi writes, Re'isisha Mishnah Brura, I saw that the Mishnah Brura, again written by the Chafetz Chaim, who's often one of our primary authorities for halachic decision making, he compromises. And he says it depends. Hela de behefseid meruba yesh lismo chalamakilin. If it is just a minor loss, if we're talking about a few boxes of cereal, that's $12, and you didn't deal with it, you didn't eat it, you didn't sell it, you just nullified them, then when Pesach is over, just throw them out and buy new cereal. It's not that big a deal, and we should follow the strict enactment of our sages. But if it's what's called a hefse meruba, a very significant loss, so then we can follow the Torah Shlomim, the Olas Shabbos, the Knesset Zebedola, those poskim who were lenient and said, listen, as long as you really did the best you could, you weren't involved in trickery, you just couldn't access your chametz, you were in jail, you were out of town, there was nothing you could do, so then we can rely on those in that particular situation. I'm going to skip a little. He discusses another case about somebody who was illegally selling alcohol against the rules of the government, who also, for obvious reasons, didn't want to sell his chametz to a non-Jew, because that would give up his whole business, whether it applies there. Anyway, he concludes and he says, Ha'ola mikola amur, what comes out from all that we've discussed is debinino didan. You can already see where this is going. In our case, kol shekin, of course, obviously, all the more, not obviously, but all the more so, te'in lahach mirach ha'pesach. They should not be stringent after Pesach. Sha'rei midina germanim ha'arur mirach shamam, kol ma sheyeshno etzel yudim shalahem hi. He gives a couple of reasons. Firstly, he says, and this is sort of the part I skipped, but he says, firstly, the Germans claim to own everything in the Jews' homes anyway. There was even a question of who owned the stuff in the Jews' homes, because Germans would walk in and take stuff, and a lot of the food that the Jews had only came because the Germans gave it to them. I mean, they gave them tiny little bits and old pieces of food, but there was a question if the Jews even had full ownership of it to begin with. But also, based on the Mishnah Brura, who says that in the case of Hefsid Meruba, in the case of a significant loss, we can be lenient. So certainly this would fall under that category. Usually when we think of a significant loss, you think of something that's, $500, $1,000. If it's just 50 bucks of chametz, okay, that's a minor loss. But a significant loss is usually something very expensive. In this case, it might have just been a few little pieces of bread, three slices of bread. That was a significant loss, because that was the difference between being super duper hungry and having a little bit of bread in your stomach that day. So, the proportions are completely different than we, thank God, comfortable, spoiled. We have a different proportion of what is considered a significant loss, but certainly any extra, any food that they had in the Kovno ghetto was considered significant. And therefore, listen, again, the halacha is the halacha. So if the answer is no, the answer is no. But since we have opinions here who are lenient, and since the Mishnah Berurah says that in the case of Hefsed Merubah, a significant loss, we can follow those lenient opinions, Rav Ashri said, practically, Lazos Hodesi Lahem, therefore, I taught to them, Lamasa, practically, that before Pesach, they should nullify their chametz that's in their homes, so he speak Oklo, that they were not able to eat before Pesach. Because according to the Torah, bittul nullification alone suffices. And after Pesach, they would be permitted to eat it. Because they were not, they had no choice. They were in a case of ones where they had no, the risk of their life. They had no other option. Because obviously they couldn't sell it to a non-Jew before Pesach. So again, this is just one of those questions where you're amazed that this predicament for the Jews in Kovno, people literally dying on the streets and starving, that they even remembered that it's Pesach, that they even were careful about not eating chametz on Pesach, that they were even careful about asking about potentially chametz shavar on Pesach after Pesach. They were still concerned with every bit of halacha that they could be, despite the circumstances. You see the seriousness with which Rav Ashri took their question. And thankfully, in this case, he was able to find a leniency so that they could eat those little extra slices of bread that they had. That's one example. There was a famous, thought I had it saved somewhere on my computer, but I'm sure you can Google it or find it. I forgot exactly where it was from. It was from one of the concentration camps. There was a famous prayer, tefillah, that the Jews said in that particular camp when they ate bread on Pesach, because they knew that it was Pesach and they had no other food. They were starving literally to death, even with the one little slice of stale bread that they had. So, of course, the right thing, actually, their obligation was to eat the little bread that they had on Pesach to help at least, some of them survive. So there was a tefillah that was written by one of the Rabbanim in this concentration camp where he basically said to Hashem, like, Hashem, we want to eat matzah. We want to keep Pesach. We have no matzah. We're starving to death. Let this bread that we eat be in place of matzah and let this count as our Seder, more or less something like that, which is just, again, heartbreaking to think of people saying something like that. In this case, I guess in the ghetto, as terrible as the circumstances were, they did have something else to eat, so they were able to, it sounds like, refrain from eating chametz on Pesach. They needed this leniency in order to be able to eat their bread after Pesach because they really didn't have much else to eat. I came across this picture, I think, a couple of years ago, and I saved it on my computer. I have a little file. And this is a picture of, I forgot, again, I should give credit. I forgot where I got this from, but it's a picture of a Seder. Oh, it says on the top left, credit Yad Vashem. So maybe you can find it there. It's a picture of a Seder in, oh, now I'm forgetting if it's, maybe it was in the Warsaw Ghetto. I think it was in the Warsaw Ghetto. But, when my Seder table, if it feels a little crowded or there's like too many, whatever, someone knocks over a bottle of wine or it feels a little stuffy in the room, this is what a typical Seder was like, because there were multiple families living in the same house, in the same room. And it's amazing just to see. You can see there's wine on the table, there's plates set up, there's candles. I think the man there is holding matzah. Everybody's trying to participate, and literally standing room only, or not even standing room only. And amazing. I don't know. To me, this picture kind of says it all of the Jews persisting through everything and still celebrating the Pesach Seder in the Warsaw Ghetto, despite it all. Anyway, I want to share one more question and answer from Rav Ashri's Sefer, and then one final thought as well. This one I'm going to just discuss much more briefly for two reasons. Firstly, as I mentioned before, this is a much longer tshuva, and it's much more complicated halachically, so it would take a long time to sort through all of the details. So I'm really just going to share briefly the main question and then skip to the end where he gives his final answer. And the other reason I'm gonna discuss it shortly is just because it's very hard to talk about. So anyway, it's really terrible, terrible, terrible situation. But see how much it also, if there's ever a time to confront the realities of what they had to face, I guess this would be the time. This is, I believe, from volume 4, Krach Dalet, She'ela Ches. So he was asked, Rav Ashri, B'din niktu ha-Germanim yado ha-Somalis. From he was asked by a man who the Germans cut off his left arm, Im yachol ha-niach tefillin al yado ha-Yamanis, whether he can put tefillin on his right arm. That's what the man came. That was his shaila to Rav Ashri. He didn't have a left arm anymore, and we put tefillin on the weaker arm. So for righties, put it on our left arm. But he didn't have a left arm. Can he put tefillin on his right arm? Not only that, the shaila, you can see the question. He writes about it for about a page and a half. He tells the story of this man. He actually writes that, interestingly, he says that this was a man who, before the war, was completely non-religious. If I understand these words correctly, it sounds like he was, says, Haskalah Mishpatit. I don't know if that means he was like a judge or a lawyer, a law teacher, a biologist, a biologist, I guess. I don't know if I'm translating Vihitstin, Milvad Yediyosav, Hanirchavos, Besav, and in addition to his vast understanding of the German language, Gambi Adias Kama Safos Eropiot Acherot, he was also fluent in other European languages. So this was a guy who was clearly very scholarly and very wise and very learned, but not at all interested in Yiddishkeit and not at all observant. But Aval Kenichla Begetto, when it's amazing story, when he was the Germans didn't care. He was Jewish, so they didn't care. Germans didn't ask, what mitzvot do you keep? What don't you keep? Or what shul do you go to? How long do you daven for? If you were a Jew, you were a Jew. So they found this guy. He was Jewish. They stuck him in the Kovno ghetto. And now that he's in the ghetto, and now he's surrounded by mostly religious Jews, the man changed from extreme to extreme. Amazing. I don't know how many stories there are like that, the people that became from in the Holocaust. He was beforehand, not a religious man, and then he went to the Kovno ghetto and became religious. Not only that, but it says that he became very steeped in Derech Emunah Tahura and pure faith, b'machshava u'maisa, in his thought and in his action. Haya noeg lispalo b'kavana gedola u'b'bechiyah. He would daven with tremendous kavana and even crying. And u'b'miyuchad haya medaktik b'kavanas ha-brachos. He was especially careful with his kavana when he said blessings and his bracha and tzitzis and tefillin. And he was very careful about the food that he ate. Really amazing story, if that's where it is. So then it says he didn't eat anything that even had a concern that it might have a kashrus issue. So really all he would eat was bread and potatoes and beans, because those were the only things that had no concerns. Then it says that somebody, there was a fellow Jew who wanted to help him out, to help strengthen his body, because like everybody else, his body was weakening. He didn't have enough to eat, starving. He was sick. So a friend helped him get a position. He got a job working in the kitchen, in one of the German kitchens. So that was considered to be a good job, because if you're working in the kitchen, you could eat a little bit while you work. They weren't treated very well, as we'll see soon, but it wasn't a great job, but at least you can snatch a little extra food so that you're a little bit less starving. So somebody with a connection was able to get him a job in the kitchen, and that was a good thing. Until Ulam, and here's where it gets really bad. Ulam ha-menahel ha-germani shel matbeach, the German who was overseeing this kitchen, shehayedua u'mufursam b'rishaso. He doesn't say who he was, I don't know his name, but who was particularly known and famous for his particular wickedness. Yimach Shemo, may his name and memory be erased. Ha'alil Allah, he fabricated about this man, Shu Gonev Tapuchea Bach, that he was stealing potatoes from the kitchen. And because of that, Ulazos, Katulo Kulab. They cut off his left arm. They removed his left arm.
Amram Shakin Hadin Minadin Haya Ra'oi Sheyiktu Ulo Shteyadav.
And they told him, really, technically, they should cut off both of his arms. They left his right arm so that they can give him terrible work, so that he still has an arm to work with. And they could punish him even worse. It uses the phrase avodas perech, which is the phrase that the Chumash and Shmos uses to describe the backbreaking labor of the Egyptians caused to the Jews in Mitzrayim. You wonder if that phrase even does justice to what the Nazis did to people like this. I don't know. Rashi says avodas perech, se avodas shemifareches es aguf, work that literally breaks the body. You know, sometimes after a long day of work, we say my back hurts, I'm exhausted. No, that's you might be tired, but this is work that literally breaks your body. You work hard enough until the bones of your body break. So this poor man, that's what they put him through. And he says, "Ein milim l'ta'ir es godel tzaro shel avrech hazeh." I don't have words to describe the pain of this young man. Al shenimna mimenu l'kayim es mitzvah sanachas tefillin al yadoh kemitzuveh. This young man was so broken over the fact that he couldn't put on his tefillin anymore. You imagine even that's what he was thinking about. That's what he was worried about. That now that they cut off his arm, he couldn't put on his tefillin anymore. But who balifanai, and he came before me because he boke up the most shlish. He came to me crying with tears, with barely alive. If you could ask other people to put his tefillin onto his right arm, obviously he only had one arm, so he couldn't even put on his tefillin anymore himself. But if you could ask other people to put on his tefillin on his right arm, halachically, what is the question? Why was he asking this question? Because the Gemara says, and it almost seems like a little, it seems a little weird to go straight from a story like that to then the Mishnah says or the Gemara says, but that's what the Sefer is. It's people who are suffering the most unimaginable horrors, but still wanted to know what is the Gemara that they still, you know, Kihem Chayinu, the Torah is our way of life. So through the good times and through the unimaginably horrific times, we turn to the Torah for guidance. And that's what he did here. He came and he asked the Shiloh. So the issue is that the Gemara in Menachos says that the Pasuk in Shema that we say every day that instructs us about the mitzvah of Tefillin says, Ukshartam la'os al yadecha. Sorry, actually, that's one pasuk. What's the other? The other pasuk says, I'm forgetting the exact phrase now. But another place where the Torah, I'm sorry, no, I don't have it in front of me. Another place where the Torah gives the mitzvah of tefillin, right, al yadcha. It says al yadcha, it should be on your hand, on your arm, and it spells yadcha. You can see here, I'm highlighting it, yadcha, yud dalet chaf hey. Usually Yadcha is spelled Yud Dalet Chaf Sofit. But here it says Yadcha Yud Dalet Chaf Hey. So the Gemara darshans, it expounds, it divides this word, and it says Yadcha, we read it as Yad Keha, your weak hand. And therefore, we see that this isn't just something that the rabbis created, but in the Torah itself, we learn that the Pasuk is teaching us that the mitzvah of tefillin shel yad, the arm tefillin, must be on the weaker arm. So for righties, we put it on our left arm, and for lefties, we put it on our right arm. And really, that's how the mitzvah is. So this man wanted to know, is it even an option to put tefillin on the right arm, or is that just not the mitzvah? You know, can I make a bracha? Especially because in the introduction, Rav Ashri said how much this man, how seriously he took his brachos. He said especially the bracha that he made on tzitzis and on tefillin. So he wants to make his bracha of l'haniach tefillin that we make on the shaliyat every day, but he didn't have his weaker arm. By the way, some posts can discuss, what about, God forbid, somebody who's only born with one arm? So that's also an interesting Shiloh, and again, beyond our focus for tonight. But there, maybe, at least you can say, if he's only born with one arm, so maybe that's considered his weaker arm, potentially. Maybe it's his stronger arm, his weaker arm, both, neither. But here, the problem is, this person had a weaker arm. He had a left arm, but now he doesn't have it anymore. So now can we say, now what do you do? So again, as I told you, the tshuva is long, and I'm skipping to the very end. And as I mentioned before, not every answer is in the halacha is the halacha. They're coming to ask a shayla. But again, you can sense that Rav Ashri, within the halacha, is trying to help this poor man who just wants to put tefillin on his arm. And who, you know, he says who even knows how long he doesn't even sound, you know, I want to put on tefillin. So let's see if he can find a way to help him. So he says, Mikolan Yir Lael, Horesi B'Nidyon Didan, based on all that I mentioned up until now, which we skipped, but he says, I instructed this man, Sha'achirim Yaniach Lo'os Tefillin Shal Yad Al Yadim, you know, that other people should put his tefillin on his right arm. But he can't make a bracha on it. Cannot make a bracha on the tefillin on shel yad because it's not really the full mitzvah. But what he can do, and this is based on again earlier poskim who use this solution in other related instances, v'yavarich shtayim al shel rosh kedas hashvus Yaakov shavesi leil. There's a tshuva from the Shavus Yaakov who says that in situations like this where you're putting on one of your tefillins in a very questionable way. So just to back up for a second, Ashkenazim at least. We say two brachos on tefillin. We say one bracha on the arm tefillin and one bracha on the head tefillin. So on the arm tefillin, we say l'aniach tefillin. And on the shel rosh, we say al mitzvah tefillin. So what the Shavuos Yaakov says is in a situation where you are putting on a one, either the head or the arm tefillin, in a questionable way, what you do to avoid the uncertainty is you say two brachos on the tefillin that you're putting on correctly. And you have in mind that that should cover the tefillin that you're putting on in a questionable way. So Rav Ashi said he really can't make a bracha on the tefillin shel yad because he's not putting it on the correct arm. But what he can do is he can make two brachos on his shel rosh, and that should cover the shel yad that he's having put on his right arm. And he explains, ki mitzvah gedola lechazek es hashoel. Part of my, you know, part of the reason here is because it's a big mitzvah to give strength to this person who's asking. Ula amtso b'avodas Hashem, to support him in the service of Hashem. The man wants to put on tefillin. You know, how can we not try to find a way that to make it halachically manageable? Me'achar shebematzavo halach bevadei b'dieved gadol. In his situation, this is far beyond ideal. V'yesh le'odedu v'yoser l'kiyama mitzvos. And we have to find any possible way to try to support him in his mitzvos. V'achein yatzam milufanai. Listen to this. This is the most mind-blowing line, I think. V'achein yatzam milufanai sameach b'tov lev. When I gave him this answer that he can have people put the tefillin on his right arm, he left from before me happy and in good spirits. And that he'll be able to continue putting on tefillin, even though he doesn't have a left arm. Be'omro. If you missed anything else, everything else, listen to this line. Be'omro. This is what he said. The Germans didn't succeed in what they're trying to do to me. They're trying to destroy me and to destroy Yiddishkeit. They cut off my arm. They tortured me. They failed, though. Ki mitzvah gedol, levatel mimeni mitzvah gedol v'chashuv azos, because they did not succeed in taking away from me this beautiful mitzvah. I will continue putting on tefillin, even though I can't wrap it on myself, even though it's not on the right arm, even though I'm dying and in pain, I won't stop putting on tefillin. And then he ends with a little tefillah of how oser yisrael b'sif ara pe'era mitzvos, mitzvah tefillin, the one Hashem who adorns Israel with glory, and who gave us this mitzvah of tefillin that's supposed to signify the glory of the Jewish people. Yezor osam begvura, should give us strength. Lizkaver al kol hakamim aleihem, disnakel begufam v'nasham, give us strength to survive, to stand up against those who are doing this to us. Suri Yisrael miskavo yeshev al rishay yagoyim es onam, Hashem, our rock, turn back onto the wicked people, give them back what they deserve. Yatzmisein berasam, let them be destroyed in their wickedness. It should be like they're gone and we're never here. And then he can let us destroy them, conquer them. Yerushalayim toshav erei Yehuda tevnana. Let Jerusalem and the Judean hills be rebuilt. Beis Hashem yiyanachon berosh harim v'Yisrael yismach b'Hashem v'yagil b'shoso. Kihur tzuruzo machso megadea karni reshaim umarovim karno tzadik. And we know that Hashem is the one who puts down the wickedness, the pride of the wicked ones, and lifts up the tzaddik. Many of his tshuvos end with a little tefillah that, you know, almost like, what's going on here? Is this what the Torah is supposed to be? A man who's coming to ask, we can put on tefillin on his right arm because the Germans cut off his left. Look at his dedication. Look at his courage. Look at his commitment. A man who only became religious a couple of years before, a couple of months before, I don't know. In the ghetto, amazing the types of questions that were asked. I conclude with one last heartbreaking thing to show you. But in the back of the first volume of Mimamagama, I didn't see this in another year, so I'm just sharing this for the first time. But you know, the section of names of people who were killed. So he writes, this is the section called Eila Akedos Tir'e. Akedos, like from Akedas Yitzchak. These are the sacrifices that you shall see. Takes a quote from Slichos that we say in Arab Rosh Hashanah, asking Hashem to avenge all of the blood that was spilled. So this is a special section where he says, Eila Shemos, these are the names, Maranan Rashei HaYeshivos V'Talmidei HaYeshivos HaKadoshos. These are the names specifically of the Rosh Yeshiva, the heads of the yeshivos, and the students of the holy yeshivos, HaKadoshim V'Tahorim Lita. The students from the yeshivos in Lita, Shenehargu Al Kiddush Hashem, Hashem Yinkom Damam, that were killed sanctifying Hashem's name. Now, obviously, in the Holocaust, every single person is a tragedy. Men, women, children, old, young, religious, not religious, every single Jew, every single human being who was killed is a world unto himself. But one of the destructions of the Holocaust included within is the world of Torah. Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbanim, people like Rav Elchanan Wasserman, who was the prime student of the Chafetz Chaim, who was considered the Gadol HaDor, the greatest Torah scholar of his generation, who left behind numerous Sfarim, even though he wasn't so old, and he probably could have published dozens more, killed by the Nazis, and hundreds, if not thousands of others similar to him. So here he goes through different yeshivas, different kollelim, different batei medrash, and he lists the people who were part of those yeshivos who were killed, and he gives a little tiny biography of each one. So here he says, Shmos Rashei V'Talmidei Yeshiva HaKadosha, these are the names of the Rabbanim and the students in the yeshiva called Knesset Yisrael B'Slabodka. So firstly, the Menahel of the yeshiva, that's like the dean of the yeshiva, HaRav Avram Grudzinski. He was born in 56, 43, Bivarsha, in Warsaw, Nisraf Bebeis HaCholim, Beghetto. He was, sounds like he was burned alive. I don't know exactly what happened in the hospital in the ghetto. Chaf Beis Tammuz Tavshin, it's Tavshin Chaf. That's 5720. So I guess at the age of whatever, 70 something. Here's a Rebbe from the yeshiva, HaRav Shraga Feivel HaLevi Horovitz. Again, he gives a little biography of when he was born, where he lived, when he died. And unfortunately, it takes a while to scroll through all this. There's lots of pages. This is all just one yeshiva. Meir Bender, Menashe Glazman, Michal Fisher, Rav Menashe Edelman, Moshe Pesach Berna. And then you get to here's a Chevrei Kolel Kovna. There was a Kolel in Kovna. That was affiliated with a different kollel called Beis Yisrael. So again, the Menahel HaKol, the dean of the kollel, was Rav Zalman Permet. He was born in 5648 in Kobrin in Poland. Nehrag, he was killed in Mar Cheshvan 5704 in Dachau. And then you have, that was a smaller one, I guess. Here's the Tells Yeshiva. The Av Beis Din of the Tells Yeshiva, Rav Avram Yitzchak Bloch, Rav Yisrael Rabinovitz, who was a Rebbe in the Yeshiva, and a whole bunch there. And this goes on for, unfortunately, about another 65 pages of different yeshivos. So, in addition, or included in everyone that we remember and that we were mourn on, and that we mourn on Yom HaShoah, and always, of course. I mean, just think about this. These are Talmidei Chachamim, pages and pages of names of Rabbanim, Talmidei Chachamim who were killed. How much Torah was lost? How much potential Torah was lost? How many Sfarim are lost? How many Shiurim are lost? How many questions and potential answers? It's just a part of the tragedy of the Holocaust, but it is a massive part who we might not realize or always be in tune to it, but because we can't even imagine what the world would be like and what the Torah would be like, what the yeshivos would be like if all of these people had not only lived, but lived and married and had children, and the world would be full of yeshivos overflowing with Talmidei Chachamim. So the least we can do is in their memory, Le'ilui Nishmasim, to add a little extra Torah learning to our own lives. That's what they would have wanted. That's what they were doing before they were killed. So we use the beautiful brachos and the lives that Hashem has given to us to learn as much Torah as we can and to try to fill the impossibly almost infinite gap, hole that is missing in the world. Anyway, we daven that we should only share good things in the future, and that this should be those pages of the Akedos, as Rav Ashri calls them, the sacrifices, the real life Akedas Yitzchaks that people experience. Those should be the last ones that we should have to hear about. All right, thank you very much for joining. Again, once again, I encourage you to also take advantage of one of the other programs tomorrow night. And Laila Tov. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.